Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 156 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second half of a two-part interview, memoirist and travel writer Horatio Clare speaks with James McConachie about difficult journeys, the manic episode that cost him his notes for an entire project, and the difference between loneliness and love of solitude. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 153.
In just 10 years, Horatio Clare has laid down what any writer would regard as a significant body of work. He began with a memoir of his parents' life and his own childhood on a hill farm in the Black Mountains, and then described, in truant, his descent down what he called the slippery slope of addiction. This was followed by a series of powerful and sophisticated pieces of travel writing. In A Single Swallow, he followed the migration route of the swallow from South Africa home to the UK. In Down to the Sea in Ships, he took two long voyages on container ships, living with the sailors. In all of his books, it seems to me that he tests the boundaries of what it means to live and to travel and to be a man. Well, the thing you pushed most of all was not every situation, though you do that throughout Truant. It was your own body and psyche. Mm. And what interests me a lot is that your next non-fiction travel book, A Single Swallow, you throw yourself, you subject yourself to, in this case, a journey, but nevertheless to quite a painful journey and a difficult journey, and one that most people would run in terror from. Can you describe what on earth possessed you to follow the track of the swallows from South Africa to the UK?
Well, I reject the premise, James. I mean, you've written yourself rough guides to the world. You know, most people gifted a ticket to Cape Town and told to make their way back overland with a small budget would love it. I was scared of it because I didn't know anything about... I mean, I knew a bit about Africa, but I didn't know anything about the kind of travel there that I was planning to do. It was just... I wanted to write a book. I bloody needed a book title, otherwise I was going to have to go and get a proper job. And I was stuck. And I was in the Pyrenees, actually, and I saw these swallows on a line, and I thought... I was actually thinking that day or the day after, I was thinking, you can make money out of animal books. But then when these guys jumped off the line, I thought, oh, got it. And indeed I had. I wrote that proposal in 2 days, sold it for what seemed a phenomenal amount of money, although if you eke it out over years, it was just reasonable, and took a plane to South Africa. So yeah, that seemed like a real score. It was a bingo.
So you knew the idea was right the moment you had it?
Yeah, easy. Follow them back, dead straight. It's got a structure. It's just a journey. It's got a point. And there, you know, it's got an attractor. People like swallows. And they have interesting parallels in terms of human migrants, which is what I really wanted to write about. But I thought, you know, you can definitely sell a book on swallows that you can't sell on human migrants.
The migrant it's really about, though, isn't it, is Horatio Clare.
Yeah, unfortunately, due to lack of swallows, I had to fall back. But I was more interested in the people, really. I mean, swallows are wonderful, and there is something magical about, and I mean magic in its purest sense, of entering into the world, you know, into the natural world, and putting yourself in the hands of its ways and its myths. That'll change you. That's half the book.
It will change you, and there's a really interesting moment in the book where you find yourself looking in a mirror after 4 days not having looked in a mirror, and you describe the shape of your face having changed.
Yeah.
It went triangular, and you'd lost a stone. And there is clearly a metamorphosis going on. Horatio is becoming swallow-like.
I was absolutely delighted to do it as well, because I was sick of the young writer, which I thought of as sort of young masturbator that I was living as in London. And I was desperate, consciously desperate, to grow up. And it occurred to me at some point through this thing that swallows, you know, this is the great growing up of the swallow, and this, if you manage it, then you get to pick a nest site, hopefully, or fight for one and make baby swallows. And I wasn't so motivated by that last bit, but definitely the growing up bit. And it did occur to me that you might meet a mate en route. But yes, it was a wonderful... I remember being absolutely non-cyclothymically, genuinely delighted in the forests of Cameroon when the travel was quite tough, and coming through it each time, and just, you know, being covered in red earth and having lost weight and being properly fit. And you talk to girls sometimes who don't eat properly, and they say the world is brighter if you don't eat. And actually, it's probably just eating a bit less. We all eat too much. And it was a very bright and transforming time. It went too far, as it was kind of bound to do, it being me, and the addition, I think, of dope later on in the journey.
Well, how far did it go?
To a full-blown manic episode in Gibraltar, which got me arrested, followed by kind of 3 days of basic manic episodes in Spain, on La Línea, opposite Gibraltar, and then in Madrid airport, where I got lost for hours, I mean hours, and then out into Madrid, a couple of days of being pretty mad out there. In Gibraltar, I threw my rucksack and containing all my everything and notebooks away.
I love the way you've just thrown that off, as if it's a side. I mean, for a travel writer writing a travel book, to throw all your notes away.
After I promised my best friend, who I'd met in Marrakesh, sort of 3 quarters of the way, I said, if anything happens to me, you get these fucking things home. He said, no problem.
I mean, I used to photocopy in anxiety my notes and post them back.
That's the way to do it.
Is that purely self-destructive, or it seemed to me something more interesting?
At the time, it was a ritual. At the time, it was exchange with the great divine power. It was fair payment to the sort of dark heart and the cliche of Africa and of the journey, that what I had been given and freely given at every turn did not really truly belong to me and shouldn't be just taken home and marketed in that way. And I needed to get rid of everything. I needed to leave Africa having taken nothing from it.
It's a rejection of a colonial enterprise,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes, yes, it's massive white guilt. And lots of readers reacted to that one way and another. There was a definite constituency of just like, every white guy this guy meets he hates, which is bullshit. But, you know, there was an aspect of that, and I'm glad I did it. You know, if you're not going to learn things and change your behaviour when you travel, there's no point. So,
did it change the writing up afterwards radically?
Not really. I mean, I think it would have been better. It would have been better and more colourful and with little sketches and things and with more for the eye and more detail and perhaps more just accuracy. The day the wind was southwest 4, you know, I had it all. And it would have been more interesting as a scientific document because it did actually, you know, as far as one was able at the time, record the journey of a swallow on land as opposed to, you know, 60 feet up. But yes, I just sat down straight away and rewrote it, and having written it once, you know, I've got a good memory. Most of it was fixed. In fact, I'm amazed when I read it how very accurate I was. But I don't make stuff up. I mean, if I'm not sure of it, I don't write it as if I am.
Why not?
Because I think it's very important that when you're making it up, you're making it up. And when you're not, you're not. And when it's blurred, the reader understands the blurring. But I go for the absolute accuracy. I mean, like you, perhaps I was trained as a newspaper reporter. So if somebody says something, I try and write down the order of the words that they used and not summarise it. Obviously, you know, I don't stand in front of people with a notebook, but I try and get it by ear. So I reproduce the sound of what I remember hearing. You know, we get into the autobiography versus fiction.
I think that's interesting and quite unusual, especially among writers like you who are, let's say, trying something with the form, pushing the writing as well as the experience. I think the novelisation of travel writings, a long and, well, maybe I wouldn't say noble tradition, but I'm struck that you feel such a duty to authenticity.
Yeah, I think I do, you know. And obviously, if you compare the tape, because ships make a tape as they drive along, like an in-flight data recorder, of the bridge exchanges with what I've got would mostly be inaccurate, but you could see that the spirit, intention and the substance were the same.
Do you think other writers who play more with,
I don't,
the fact,
know.
Does it give you a problem in them, or is it just, is this something that you...
I think we all do much the same. I mean, you're trying to get the close to the veracity of a situation. Maybe you're working it, and of course you're cutting it, so you're editing it anyway. But just the way I work is very much by ear. You know, I write description by eye, by my mind's eye, and I write everything else, dialogue and everything, which is where most of the information is conveyed, if you're any good, by ear, which kind of... It's not a moral thing. It's a technical thing. That's how I think I do it.
It's striking as a male travel writer. There is a slice of masculine travel writing where the protagonist hero is pushed as a hero, and I feel almost that you're doing the opposite of that. You're presenting yourself as some sort of anti-hero. I mean, from the most superficial things, like the scrapes you get into, to give it a faintly pejorative description, to the failure that you accommodate.
Mine?
Well, not as a writer, but in the journey, the bits that... that go wrong when you are forced to take a flight because you can't.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. Total, when it all goes to farce and the idea packs up against reality and you're left with do you kind of gloss over this bit or do you just tell them what happened? I mean, why didn't I go through the DRC, most interesting country in Africa in many ways? Well, because Tim Butcher's Blood River had just come out and it was done and on the border they told me you can go through but it will absolutely strip you of everything you've got. You can't even negotiate at the checkpoints. I thought, stuff that. Nobody's written about the Republic of Congo. I'll fly there. And yeah, I'm a pretty lazy writer in that way and quite goal-oriented, I suppose. It's important to me to enjoy it, and when you don't, to not be enjoying it for a good reason. I don't know. The anti-hero and the scrapes. I mean, travel writers pray for incident and setback, as you know, because it's fun and telling. And the anti-hero... I got really sick of I, and of course all my books have this bloody character in them who is the I, and I loathe it. And one of my keyboards, the I packed up. I thought, I'm doing too much of this. But it's just, it's the constraint of the form. And, they're produced in different circumstances, and I was aware that I really didn't want to be the forefront of a single swallow, and that I had no way of not being.
The book that followed in the same genre, Down to the Sea and Ships, is... striking in how little I there is. So good. I'm interested that this was a conscious...
Oh, yeah, I got better at it. And I was really explicit about it. I said it in the proposal, in the swallow, that I wouldn't be in it. And then I said it again in the ships, but I obviously meant it. And so, yes, much less, which is good. And that's true to the experience of it, actually, because you want to be as little as possible in the way on a ship. You don't want to change the narrative. We don't really want to prod life in, apart from asking the questions. And you don't want them to be... obscured in any way by your presence.
Them, your...
The sailors, your subjects, yeah, your heroes. And so then it becomes... You are obtrusive on the voyage, so, if anybody else had written the book, I would also not appear very much. I'd just mostly be, on the wing of the bridge or gossiping, having a fag behind the superstructure.
Or there's one other place which... it's rather amusing. You suffer with the ventilation in your cabin, so you appear as a kind of bad lung.
Yeah, you do share. That's lovely. It's wonderful to have bodily experience and to be able to write physically. And obviously, it can be appallingly uncomfortable and dangerous at the time. But it's ace, and I do love that. I did a piece not long ago for the Financial Times, and we were canoeing down Kafue River in Zambia, and a hippo bit my canoe in half just behind where I was sitting. This massive hippo bit the canoe in half in front of the man in the back, and we so nearly died. And
Horatio just looked round behind him as if visualising the bite.
The thing was, I never saw the hippo. One minute I'm paddling along, next minute the front of the canoe came up and hit me in the face. And then we're in the water, and the canoe's half popped. It was an inflatable canoe. And we're both looking at each other. And I haven't written about it, really. I put it very low key in the FT piece. But that's what you want. I don't want to get any closer to it. But it's great. And, you'd read a book with a hippo attack in it. So you're just lucky that you've got one to write.
Well, there is a kind of hippo attack in Down to the Sea and Ships in that you sail through what sounds to me like an absolutely terrifying storm.
Yeah, we sailed through some wonderful storms in the North Atlantic.
See, you say wonderful.
They were.
This is the difference.
Because the people, you wouldn't have been terrified because you'd have just done what everyone does, which is you look at the captain and he embodies the ship and our response to it, kind of. And if he's not worried, you're not worried. And the chief engineer, of course. And they weren't worried, so I wasn't really. But yeah, it was rock and rolling and very colourful and violent and magnificent. And that's the beautiful thing about travel writing, is that you really do get to stand in the most amazing, just the simple, true parts of the earth where normally people don't stand, or not your sort of people. And then you bring it back. That's why it's lovely to do this interview here, actually, in the centre of London off Fleet Street, because you're aware that all these taverns were made by people coming back from trips with one thing or another, but stories were the constant and the thing that we originally sold. I mean, I guess my kind of travel writing descends from voyage accounts, which is sort of spying, really. But spies do it for the disadvantage of somebody and the advantage of somebody else. Travel writers, in theory, do it for the advantage of everybody. I love the BBC's motto, "Nation shall speak peace unto nation." And that's sort of what I think it's about.
Well, you talked about political ambitions for each of your book, and I think in Down to the Sea in Ships, that comes through... not polemically, the polemic is more apparent. You really are quite angry about the conditions under which seafarers labour.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of the wind, you know, it's not a story in China, I tell you that. When I toured the book in China, people just looked blank. The idea of men being forced to work away from home for bugger all in terrible conditions didn't really strike them as news. Yeah, it's a huge factor in the way we live, and it's impossible not to get cross about it. And the trick, of course, is to restrain that anger and turn it into expression, which is something I'm still learning to do. And you learn very quickly that the more politics overtly you put into a book, the fewer it sells. So you've got to let people come to their own decisions.
You talk about men being sent away to work, to labour in bad conditions. Mm. I mean, and you talk about having wanted to write about migrants in a single swallow. Mm. There is an act of empathy with the men right at the heart of the book. I mean, this is what I walk away thinking about.
Sailors.
Is the sailors.
Yeah.
And the Filipino sailors in particular, even though you describe it having been harder to get under the skin of their experience.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And it's wonderful when you realise that you've found a subject that you can get behind, because I can cheer on all day about sailors. I can't, you know, it doesn't really interest me to continue selling Horatio Clare's book about them, but it's been an absolute joy to do both.
Well, you clearly admire them.
I do, intensely.
I mean, and you admire their version of masculinity.
I do, absolutely.
Can you describe how you talked about this? Some sort of self-sufficiency that you seem to identify within many of the sailors you met.
That's right. They're all a nation of one, in a way. They're all kind of the deep, we talked about loneliness and isolation versus love of solitude and companionship, comradeship, competition, hierarchy. They live at the sort of nexus of all of those things. And just because the sea is such an unforgiving place, it only lets the best stay out there, really. You know, you can get complete bastards, no doubt, but if they're not competent, they'll be dead. So it is a very interesting place, and it does show our gender in a very fine light, actually, as it happens, which, you know, if you read the newspapers about the doings in the City of London today, is not necessarily the case. And if you meet women who've married sailors, I may be completely wrong, but anecdotally, I'm bloody not, they tend to marry good men. Yeah, it breeds self-sufficiency, self-control, above all, discipline, professional kind of optimism, the same thing you meet with very good soldiers. And it does interest me, because we need to find ways of harnessing, you know, all of masculinity's multiple forces for good and for harmony if we're to prosper. Because, you know, things can get lost along the way. If we're not careful, we're all going to be replaced by drones. Then what are men going to do? Because we know women will be running the place.
There's a part of the book which describes your accommodation with this vision of masculinity. There's a part of it that seems faintly in conflict with other things you say about the romantic within you. I mean, you say that, you know, the lucky ones, the lucky romantics, never grow up. And yet there seems to be nothing less romantic than the captain of a container ship. I mean, of course, from the outside it feels romantic, but when you look at the way you describe what they're doing, the incredible self-possession, care, focus, is romanticism and adult masculinity, are they in conflict?
That's interesting. No, I don't think so. But one needs to harness the other, I suppose. I do think that, you know, my friends among seafarers, when they talked about their life, the lucky ones there liked it and did feel romantic about it and did see the beauty and the lyricism and the power and the sheer astonishing scale of it as nurturing and, you know, wonderful things in terms of self-possession and full adulthood, in a way, which I suppose we're talking about. So can the full adult be romantic? Yes. Yes, I would say so. You know, there's a yearning melancholy, you would say solipsistic side to romanticism, which actually in some ways is enhanced by the isolation and the rigours of the sea. You know, you've got your cabin for 9 months, or 2 months if you're a captain, 6 months if you're an officer. So that does sort of push towards introspection, perhaps, but you can't show it as soon as you leave the cabin door. So you have to get very good at dividing personalities, which I think men are quite good at. I do think we're more fragmented in some ways than women and can switch from one thing to another.
The captains in particular feel heroic.
Yeah.
Did you feel that about
the
time?
Yeah. Oh, no question. It's a heroic job. I mean, it's a job that selects for heroes. Certainly at the top end of the market, where you are truly responsible for people and actually feel that responsibility. I mean, I'm sure it also selects for absolute tossers. And I saw one in West Africa who emerged from his cabin in gold-rimmed sunglasses and took over just in time to sort of crash the ship. fool. And they caused deaths. But, you know, the ones I met, and a great many of them, are in some ways, well, they're the lead player in a real drama. So they occupy the heroic role, whether or not they do the personality. And things like decisiveness and sensitivity and sophistication and subtlety and an embodiment, a performative side, all of those come with the job. And they're wonderful to witness, and so easy and fun to write about and to talk about. Yeah, it was great. And of course, you know, partly because of an absent father, but also a very lovely, wonderful father. I've always looked at men. I looked to men to see what it is that they are. And so the ships was an absolute gift that way. And I'm about to go back on an icebreaker with what is supposedly, allegedly, very taciturn Finnish sailors for 10 days. And so I'm going to get a whole lot more of that.
Is this for another
book? Another book, yeah.
The Finns, of course, are legendary Finnish sailors in particular, I think, for superstition.
Are they? Shit. Thank you. I'll know. I'll look up. Go on.
It's a strain of in your work. It's not there much, but there are whispers and flickers.
Yeah, I do believe in ghosts, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you call it superstition, I would simply call it, you know, unknown science. I do feel that there is more to the world. You know, I'm called Horatio, I've got no choice. But, yes, I don't think it's just me being mad. I think there are things we don't understand, but we intuitively do.
Well, it goes right back to Running for the Hills and the Welsh Hill Farm. There are ghosts of some kind there.
Yeah.
Or they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all echoes. You're performing the same rituals in the same places, often in the same conditions for the same purposes.
And that comes across in Down to the Sea in Ships as well, as you sail across the graveyard of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that
meant?
Oh,
it was just astonishing.
Like?
So I had a wonderful book called The Real Cruel Sea by Richard Woodman, and he just catalogues in a way, you know, something of the carnage that took place in the North Atlantic during the Second World War. During the time of the Atlantic convoys, and you sail over it all, and they're all there below you. And if you know, with a bit of comparison, you can pretty well work out whose grave you're chugging over now, and all their scattered cargoes on the floor, seafloor below you. And I remember seeing The Cruel Sea when I was very young, just a bit of it, the bit where they're trying to get out of the ship that's sinking, and my mother saying, "It's the cruel sea," and this phrase really ringing with me. And so when you plunge across it on a rusty old freighter in February in a gale, in the darkness, and in total darkness, and the ship's plunging wildly, and it's freezing and mad outside, it is eerie as hell. The sea is absolutely alive. If you took a clairvoyant or some one of these spiritual nutters out there, that, you know, all the bells would go off. The sea is all memory. It's amazing. And I've been privy to several what our forefathers would have called either kind of pagan or religious experiences in the course of my life and writing. I don't exactly seek them out, but if I get a whiff of them, I'm very interested.
Such as what?
Miracles, things that shouldn't happen, things that science doesn't explain, bushmen holding burning coals, kind of curses and wishes, blessings, people seeing things that don't exist, like mermaids, or people who aren't lying to you, telling you what they think, people mortally afraid of dragons that shouldn't exist but apparently do, and who can meet, you know, who can cheat, take you to their victims' relatives, that sort of thing. But the great kind of colour and pageantry of the world, I'm just conscious that it's the writer's job to make sure you get it right to the edge of the frame, you know, as it were. And if there is no frame, say so.
How do you mean right to the edge of the
frame?
Well,
if you imagine kind of the world as a picture, you know, the stuff in the middle we all write about and know about. But as you move out towards the rims, literally and figuratively, things start getting interesting and less explicable, perhaps, and that you should be alert to that.
That's interesting. You wrote in Truant many books ago how you wanted, to write about the edges of things.
I hadn't thought of that. Yes, well, that wasn't what I meant, but I think it is what I meant. Yes, that's true. Well, you're always looking for material, and of course I say the world refreshes itself, but, you know, no one's going to write in Patagonia. Well, actually, you probably could now, but it does feel quite well explored by the smartphone, you know. You've got to bring something distinctively new, and if that's a ghost, that's probably, you know, good copy.
Well, a superstition of mine is not to ask people about their next book, but we got on to your Finnish icebreaker for a moment. And I wonder, is that another journey? Is it part of a... What do you
well,
want
from
that?
Well, it's a tricky one, you see, because Down to the Sea in Ships should have been three voyages. But when I'd done two, I had enough material for the book, and I had things that I couldn't, you know, I should be doing, like having a child. So I didn't do the third part. And then this coincidence has occurred, and I can go on an icebreaker for 10 days, which people aren't normally allowed to do unless they're working on it. in the Gulf of Finland in February, and I've sold a book on it, and I'm tremendously excited about it because it's a real, like, a test of all the craft. So the research has to be done because the delivery line is quick. It's got, you know, I've got about 2 months to write this sucker, if I'm honest, and it's only 50,000 words, but it's got to be not feel rushed, it's got to be truthful, quick, deep, telling, and it's got to include a lot of stuff. So I'm really interested in ice. Obviously, it's an issue of great environmental moment, but physically it's very interesting stuff. And I'm very interested in Finland, which is effectively a nation created out of a book and a couple of tunes by Sibelius and the Kalevala, this book of myths. It's only 100 years old, and of course, at the same time, it's ancient. They've got witches like hell on the Lapland coast. apparently, the, you know, Iceland was discovered by, or Spitsbergen was discovered by people from there who turned into killer whales and then turned back into it and discovered it, which makes sense of the navigational conundrum otherwise raised. So it's everything, all the ducks have to be lined up, and I have to be lucky and clever to pull it off. But I think I will. I'm confident, and it's so interesting. So it turns out icebreakers have quite interesting walk-on parts in Finnish history, for example. So yeah, I'm excited about it. And it came out of nowhere, and it wasn't supposed to be what I wanted to do. What I really, really want to do, this is a superstitious bit, as it were, that I wouldn't be telling you normally, is I really want to write a book about borders called Strolling Under the Razor Wire, where you walk along the borders of Fortress Europe and you talk to the people who are building them and the people who are guarding them, people who live there, people who live on both sides. And not so much the refugees, less so, just the people of the border areas. Because I really think it's very, you know, borders is the great question of our time. I don't believe in them. I think in 200 years' time they won't exist.
Well, there's anywhere. A magical moment in A Single Swallow where you describe the absurdity of our borders from the swallow's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, which is also, you know, the planet's perspective, and we're going to need it.
Well, so the swallow, if you can help me, I wouldn't want to put it in my words, but from the swallow's perspective, the world turns, it remains still with the season, it seeks, and it's we staying in the same place. Have I captured...
Yeah, that's true in some ways. Yes, it's interesting physical things happen when you look from the swallow's perspective, because they travel in a bubble of permanent spring. They turn against, as it were, the kind of the wobble of the Earth's axis, and in space they're quite fixed points. Yeah, it starts to get interesting. So yeah, something like that I'd like to do. But no, it's going to be Icebreaker, and the next one that comes out is a children's book about. It's the first Brexit children's book, Aubrey and the Terrible Ladybirds. It's about a bunch of ladybirds who turn up from Central Europe and can't understand why everyone hates them and wants to stamp them out because they've been in the papers as killer ladybirds. Yeah, and the local ladybirds don't like them anyway because they didn't eat too many aphids. So that's just a proof stage.
Well, it's an interesting turn in your career. I mean, I focused on your non-fiction, which is effectively just my interest, but... You've done many other things.
Well, I don't think I can write fiction for adults, really, not very effectively. I mean, I've done sort of novella, little things and short stories, maybe, but really children's writing is where I can finally be the figure I've always fantasised about being. And it, for a fantasy, appropriately, the audience are tiny and innocent. They don't know any different. So, yeah, no, it's wonderful. It's just something that happened in my 40s. My friend Sarah Dinant said you might find that you're something else in your 40s,
yes.
And I have.
I wonder if you mentioned having a stepson and a son. The choice to write for children must be informed by that.
Yeah, kind of. Well, the first thing I tried to do with Robin, my stepson, was turn him into material. So I wrote half a book called Radio Free Rochdale, which is about being a step-parent to another class, another culture, you know, being Southern me, essentially, although I, you know, protest about being from Wales. As far as they're concerned, we're all Southerners. And moving into this child's life when his father was, you know, not yet out of it, really, their parents were separated, and becoming a stepfather. And that would have been a decent book, actually. It's not finished. I just got sidetracked with it. Started writing about Rochdale instead of step-parenting in a way. But no, the coming of Aubrey, I think it was actually a panicked need to earn money rather than... Although he did provide me with a character and a name. I nicked his name. And
so
I
will
nicked
he get
his
a share of the royalties?
Will he get a share of the royalties? Yeah, he'll get the estate.
In due course.
He'll be laughing. Yeah, well, I spent most of the advance... I mean, all of it, of course, on his nappies. So...
Horatio, it's been a pleasure and a privilege to... speak to you, and I can't wait to read the Finnish Icebreaker book.
It's been an honour to be so interestedly and interestingly questioned. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
That was Horatio Clare in conversation with James McConachy. You can find out more about Horatio on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 156, which was recorded by James McConachy and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 157, we have the first instalment of our new series, Breakpoint, in which writers Cherise Saywell and Cynthia Rogerson describe what nearly sank their writing careers and how they turned things around. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.